You're listening to a program produced in 2017 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud.
I'll never forget my first visit to a cemetery that wasn't for a funeral or visiting a gravestone of a deceased family member. It was almost 20 years ago, and I was in Pátzcuaro, Michoacán, Mexico, for Day of the Dead. The entire town was bright with orange marigolds hanging from ceilings, placed on altars, and scattered throughout the cemetery. Families gathered around the gravestones of their deceased, picnicking. Children ran in between tombs, jumping and hiding. Candles flickered in the dark night. There was joy and reverence. The scene was so unfamiliar to what I knew and understood, but it was beautiful, and it prompted my own journey of questioning how we treat our dead. Author, mortician, and funeral home owner and operator, Caitlin Doty, brings us along on her journey in her second book, From Here to Eternity, Traveling the World to Find the Good Death, in the best way possible when discussing such a subject, with humor, a bit of an adventure, and an open mind. Doty's death-positive approach is written into her tales that chronicle her observation and research on ritual, grieving practices, and dead body preparation from Japan to Joshua Tree, Colorado to Indonesia. The inclusion of beautifully illustrated vignettes that accompany the text throughout also allow for the reader to ponder and envision Doty's descriptions within the reader's own visual framework, and they allow for so much imagination. Her thoughtful and smart prose is also witty and playful, not unlike her popular video series, Ask a Mortician, on YouTube, where you can learn some morbidly fascinating facts about embalming or post-mortem birth, for example. At the heart of Doty's work, though, is the intent to educate and also reform the profit-driven American funeral industry to make death practices more humane, natural, and ecologically responsible. Her first book, Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, was a New York Times bestseller. She's also the founder of The Order of the Good Death, an organization that supports death-positive culture and to open dialogue around death practices and engage people in their mortality. And in case you were wondering where to get a hold of her to talk shop, she lives here in Los Angeles, where she runs her nonprofit funeral home, Undertaking LA. In conversation with Caitlin tonight is Carolyn Kellogg, book editor of the Los Angeles Times. Carolyn is a recipient of the paper's editorial award, and she is a vice president of the board of the National Book Critics Circle. She is a book lover, book supporter, and book advocate in all ways possible, and is an Aloud supporter on both sides of the stage as moderator and audience member alike. And we're delighted to have her joining Caitlin Doty in conversation tonight on the Aloud stage at the LA Public Library. Let's give them a warm welcome.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for coming. We know that you have the choice of coming here or going to watch the End of the World series. Is there anybody here who's a huge Dodger fan? Raise your hand. Huge? Okay. I want somebody to be responsible for one of you big fans. If the Dodgers pull ahead, raise your hand and wave it like this so we know they're winning. Otherwise, we're just going to talk about death.
Yeah, otherwise we're going to talk about death. That's what's actually on the agenda for this evening.
So I wanted to start by asking you, what was the furthest experience you had in this book where you travel the world from our own sort of American death experience, funeral experiences?
Well, probably rural Indonesia, which was the furthest quite literally by distance. We had to fly from here to Tokyo, from Tokyo to Jakarta, from Jakarta to Makassar, and then a 10-hour drive up into the rural mountains of Indonesia. And once we were there, it was completely different than mourning that you would ever see in the United States. It was, in this village, what they do is they mummify their dead. It used to be that they mummified them with tea leaves and tannins, almost like you would leatherize an animal. But now they do it more similar to an American embalmer, where they just stick some formaldehyde or formalin in the body to preserve it. And even years later, they will take the dead bodies out of their house-shaped graves, and they'll unwrap them, and they'll clean the bodies with a paintbrush, like the kind you would get at a hardware store, and then redress the bodies, take family photos. I was in some pictures that they made me be in to post to Instagram with a mummy and the whole family. And I would be like, oh, no, let's not do that. But they would insist, because I was this big white girl, and it was kind of fun that I was there. And they were like, oh, grandma would love this. It's hilarious. So I was in those photos. And then they would put them back after several days into the grave. And for us as Americans, the idea of taking mom and being around mom and living with mom for that long seems a little Norman Batesy, seems a little psycho. But there, it feels really, really normal.
And is this a tradition that stems back generations? Like, when did they start leaving their dead around to out and hang out with?
It is, yeah. So they originally, so Indonesia is a majority Muslim country. It's the largest Muslim country in the world. But this area of South Sulawesi, originally they practiced an animistic religion called Aluk Tudolo, which means the way of the ancestors. But Christianity came in the early 20th century, so now it's this really interesting hybrid of the old religion and Christianity. So you'll have these mummies coming out of these house-shaped graves, but the house-shaped grave will have like white Jesus in tableau on the front of it. And you know, as with the Catholic and Protestant church around the world, with a lot of these more intimate, interactive traditions, the church isn't super happy about it. They don't, they don't put it in their brochures at the Vatican or anything that there are these places, rural areas that are doing this, but they basically leave them alone to continue the practice.
And the notion is not that, so I'm just, this doesn't actually come through in the book, but with grandma, mm-hmm. has she gone to heaven?
She has and she hasn't. So my friend Paul Koudinaris, who I traveled with, he has this idea of the soft border between living and the dead, which in America, it's more of a hard border. When someone dies, we may believe they're in heaven, but we also believe that they're dead. Whereas in this place in Indonesia, they believe that the person is still there, essentially. Not completely there, they're kind of a liminal space, but when they bring the mummy out and they're saying, hey, we brought you some cigarettes, or we're going to put this paisley tie on you, or your daughter's coming from the main village tomorrow, they believe that grandma is taking that in and that she's still, available in this physical mummified form to take in this information.
And how responsible did you feel for being an outsider to this culture, sort of witnessing this very specific and unique ritual?
Yeah, very responsible. My editor will tell you this. There's about 10 pages that we cut out of me just navel-gazing about that, me being like, oh, I'm a white girl, but it also feels like I'm a tourist, but I'm not really a tourist. What does this mean? And he was like, red line, like, Caitlin, we need like two lines about this. People don't care that much about your feelings about this. But I think that I think Indonesia is an especially good example where I felt this the most strongly, because in Indonesia, in this particular area, they do have a tourist industry around death. Not really with the mummies, that's really deep, deep, deep in the mountains of Indonesia, but in Makassar, which is the, or not Makassar, in Tanatoraja, Rantapau, which is this area in South Sulawesi, other areas of Indonesia have really been a hit with tourists, Bali, for instance. And they're thinking, okay, what do we have that is going to get butts in the seats and tourists to come to us? And what they have are these really impressive death rituals.
So instead of ecstasy on the beach?
Yeah, exactly. It's corpses in, you know, buffalo slaughter and mummies. Exactly. So they bring people there, and it's not American tourists, really. It's European tourists, Dutch, German, and a lot of tourists from around Indonesia, because it really is, the equivalent would be, Indonesia is such a huge country, such a diverse country, that really this small area with the mummies, to them is kind of like a church where they speak in tongues would be to us. You know, it's such a rural area that they're like, well, I heard that there are mummies there. Are they zombies? We went in the airport when we were saying where we were going for them to stamp our passport. The woman who worked there was like, oh, where are you going? Tanatoraja. Oh, are you going to see the dead people? You're going to see the mummies? And we said yes, and she was like, oh, really? I'm afraid of them. They're zombies. They're, you know, and she had all of this, you know, idea of what we were going to see, that, you know, and for me, I assumed I would go there, and she would be like, oh, yeah, of course, Tanatoraja, our premier mummy area of the country. But she was just as, like, confused and weirded out about
it
as anyone else, you know.
So how did you put together your, so the book, you go to these various countries. How did you put together your itinerary, your agenda for where you would go?
I just spun the globe, and wherever my finger landed, I was like, corpses, we're going. No, that's not how it happened.
What's your death practice?
Yeah, yeah, it could be anything. We'll see. Really how I put it together is I wanted to make sure everywhere that I went that it was a place that I had some kind of specialized access to. So I didn't want it to just be a ritual that I showed up and was like, hey, I heard your dad died. That sucks. Like, what's going on, friends?
Are you going to burn him?
Yeah, you're going to burn him. You're going to bury him. You're going to mummify him. What you going to do? I didn't want to do that. So it had to be a place that I knew that I could get access that even a journalist couldn't get, or that certainly a tourist or a person who just showed up couldn't get. So it had to be someone I knew, someone, or I had some sort of special connection to it. And fortunately, when you work in the death world, it's a very, very small world.
Is there like a cabal of cool death people?
100%. Yes, there absolutely is. And we all know each other.
So
Colin Dickey, who we both know, is one of them.
How do we buy in? Like, how do we get to hang out with the cool death people?
Do some death stuff, my friends. Yeah, do some death stuff. Really, I get asked a lot, you know, have you ever heard of the person who does body composting? Or have you ever heard of this mushroom burial suit? And it's like, yes, we're best friends. We know each other very well. We don't, you know, this is such a small group that, of course, we all know each other. And it's growing all the time because there's so many people doing really interesting work in the death space, I guess you would call it. But yeah, it's a small group, but one with a lot of creative, interesting people in it.
And it's an international group, or just everybody is kind of, the Americans are wired into what the best death things are?
I think the Americans are most wired into the best death things because we're the worst at death. So there's the most need for it here. So people are more, you know, frantic to be innovative and frantic to figure out some new way of doing this because we just do it so poorly. But yeah, it's absolutely international. This isn't really in the book, but I was also in Berlin and Australia and New Zealand, and everywhere I went, I was able to tour funeral homes there. And that's why I stand by the fact that the Americans are the most in denial about death and perhaps have the worst death system. But the whole Western world, the whole English-speaking world, Western world, has their problems with fear of death and not getting what they want out of the death experience.
What do you mean by that?
Everybody should have a list of all the things they want out of a fabulous death experience. What I mean by that is that, in general, people in those countries feel like they pay too much for their funerals. They feel like they're a secondary part of it, like they give up the corpse to some professional and it disappears and that's their only involvement. So a lot of the work that I do is advocate for funerals that are less expensive and more family involved, because the more involved you are in the death process, the less expensive it's going to be.
Okay, so I wanted to ask for a show of hands. Mm-hmm. How many people in the room have seen a dead body? Wow.
How many of you, which is a lot of people. This is a self-selecting crowd, to be fair. So how many of you have seen Adambare? How many of you have interacted with it, not just walked by it, you know, and touched its hand, but actually washed it or dressed it or sat with it? Yeah, that's a much smaller group. Yeah.
But it's a much bigger group than,
if you
around
pulled,
my office.
Yeah, no, exactly. No, if you polled, like, the people in Dodger Stadium right now, it probably wouldn't be. But yeah, I think that that's also a big deal in the American funeral industry, is that what I saw in going around the world is you see these cultures that are just so much more engaged with the actual process of the funeral and actually preparing the body. And in America, what we get a lot of is you get the body that's laid out in the casket, and it has the makeup on, and it has the suit on, and the flowers, and you kind of awkwardly shuffle by and tap grandma's hand, and it doesn't feel, you feel like you're there, and you feel like you see the body, but again and again, people tell me, especially younger people, that it doesn't mean much to them, that it doesn't move them, that it didn't feel like they were really involved or present in that experience. It was just a corpse on show, on display to them. And that's something that we can change pretty easily here if we are brave enough to do so.
So is one of the obstacles our contemporary, like, funereal industry? Maureen mentioned a little bit about this. You're an advocate for...
Yeah, that's the main problem, I think. I think that we've come so far that is as a culture that it's hard for me to blame anyone in this crowd now for being distant from death and not saying, like, oh yeah, I'm going to hang out with mom's corpse, no problem. Get me in there, coach, to make a baseball reference. and that we've come so far, and that it really, at this point, death professionals have to be the ones to step up and say, I want our own industry to change. We are not doing enough for our families. We're not doing enough for them to be involved. And we have to do more. But I think that the general consensus among death professionals, funeral directors, etc., is we are the professionals. We are the ones who know how to do this. And it would be giving up some kind of fundamental sense of self for them, self-esteem for them, to acknowledge that the family should be more involved. There are several funeral homes that I have friends who work at Los Angeles that if a family comes in and says, you know what, could I just, this would mean a lot to me, this was mom's favorite lipstick, can I just put the lipstick on mom? They'll say, no, you're not qualified to do that. We don't want you doing that. We don't want you messing with the body, basically. And my contention is, if your idea of yourself as a professional is based on you putting lipstick on a corpse, and that's what gives you your special skill, you're in the wrong business, because anybody can do that. Absolutely anybody can do that. And in fact, if you let the actual family member do it, it becomes this almost sacred, moving ritual that you're doing with mom. And if you're just the paid funeral home employee who does that, it's a waste of a sacred moment, almost, that you could give as a gift to this family.
And do you think that is the key for being as a profession, being able to enable families to have a sacred moment rather than figuring out what to do with, like, a corpse that might be, like, leaking and stuff?
Yes. I think that is what a funeral director's job should be. A funeral director's job shouldn't be, oh, this body is dangerous, I'm going to take it behind the scenes and make it safe for you, because the body's safe. That's really old science. We know that that's not really the issue. But a funeral director's job should be, I am the one who is facilitating this experience for you. I want you to come out of this feeling like you have the tools to continue on in your grief. It's not like you're going to go through a thing and all of a sudden your grief will be gone. You're still going to have a grieving period, but we need to have this time that's sacred, even if you're secular, but still ritualistic, still sacred, that you can have these moments, even if it's as simple as putting lipstick on mom, even if it's simple as brushing her hair, sitting there and holding her hand. You have these moments, and then we set you off with a clear sense of purpose about how you're going to start to integrate this grief into your life. And that's what we should be there for. We're not there to manage the dead body. We're there just to help and facilitate that experience.
So it's interesting to me that of the places that you went and the different cultures that you explored, some were had these rituals that feel like ancient and old-fashioned, and some were technologically advanced and like futuristic almost. I was going to make a bad joke about Logan's Run, but nobody floating up. But I wonder if you could read to us from your book about one of the more futuristic
experiences. Yeah, sure. I'd love to do that. Yeah. I'm going to walk up to the podium to be very official. You know what this podium does? Because Los Angeles, look at this. Speaking of futuristic, speaking of the future of podiums. So this is when I was in Japan. The Buddhist temple, a 17th century building tucked away off a quiet street in Tokyo, is home to a modest cemetery with aged headstones representing generations of families that have come to worship here. Yajima Jushoku, Jushoku means head priest or monk, emerged to greet me, an affable man in a brown robe with close-cropped white hair and glasses. In contrast to his archaic surroundings, Yajima Jushoku is a man of new ideas, specifically how to memorialize cremated remains, my kind of guy. When the temple reached capacity, the priest Yajima could have invested in old-fashioned cemetery space. Instead, 7 years ago, he built the Ruriden Columbarium. Columbaria are separate buildings for storing cremated remains. Buddhism has always been state of the art, he explained. It's quite natural to use technology alongside Buddhism. I see no conflict at all. With that, he showed me through the doors of the complex's newest hexagonal building. We stood in the darkness while Yajima punched something into a keypad at the entrance. Moments later, 2,000 floor-to-ceiling Buddhas began to glow and pulse a vivid blue.
What?
I bleated, stunned and delighted. I had seen photographs of Ruriden, but to be surrounded 360 degrees by luminous Buddhas was overwhelming. Yajima opened a locked door, and I peeked behind the Buddha walls at 600 sets of bones. Labeled to make it easy to find Miss Kubota-san, he smiled. Each set of cremated remains corresponded to a crystal Buddha on the wall. When a family member comes to visit Ruriden, they either type in the name of the deceased or pull out a smart card with a chip, similar to the cards used on Tokyo subways. After the family keys in at the entrance, the walls light up blue, except for one single Buddha shimmering clear white. No need to squint through names trying to find Mom. The white light will guide you straight to her. Yajima headed back to the keypad controller and instructed me to stand in the center of the room. The autumn scene, he announced, and the formations of Buddhas turned yellow and brown with shifting red patches, like piles of freshly fallen leaves. Winter scene, and the Buddhas turned to snowdrifts of light blue and white. Shooting star, and the Buddhas turned purple as white spots jumped from Buddha to Buddha, like a stop-motion animation of the night sky. This LED light show could have been a Disney production, but there was something in the sophisticated design of the lights that made it feel as though I was being swaddled in a technicolor womb. Yajima invited me for tea inside the temple and offered me a stool brought out for visiting foreigners. He believed I couldn't endure sitting cross-legged on the floor for the duration of tea and conversation. I assured him I absolutely could. I couldn't. My legs fell painfully asleep within the first 3 minutes. I asked Yajima why he had designed Ruriden the way he did, and his response was impassioned. We had to act. We had to do something. The family is supposed to look after your grave, but we don't have enough people to look after everyone's grave. We had to do something for the people left behind. Each morning, Yajima enters Ruriden and punches in the day's date. That morning, he punched in May 13th. Several Buddhas glowed yellow, representing the people who had died on that day. Yajima lit incense and prayed for them. He remembers them, even if there's no family left to do so. For an elderly man or woman with no remaining family, the glowing Buddhas at Ruriden will act as their afterlife community. Yajima Jushoku may be a powerful priest, but he's also a designer. When I pray, I also think about creating. How do we create something new, filled with dazzling light? How do we create new Buddhas? For him, the act of prayer is essential to creativity. Every time I pray, the different ideas pop up. I'm not a man who sits at a desk to create a plan. It's all while I'm praying. What if Ruriden fills up with ashes? If it fills up, then I will consider a second or third, Yajima smiled. I'm already thinking of them. I'm back. That's it. That's a drawing, obviously, but imagine it all blue.
So talk to me a little bit about the art in the book and how you ended up coming up with this sort of stunning illustration.
Yeah, the first interview...
I feel like I'm sitting in, in there right
You're
now.
You're swaddled in your own Technicolor womb. The very first interview I did for the book was with Vice magazine, and of course the Vice reporter is like, why didn't you just have pictures of the mummies? I could have handled it. I want the real stuff. And I was like, oh, this is a very Vice magazine question. But I thought that, you know, there's the people who follow me and enjoy my work and of course would be totally fine with pictures of the actual mummies and the actual skulls and the actual bodies. But I felt like if I wanted to make this a book that was for everyone, anyone who even was afraid of death and wanted to come to the book and find it, that it had to be more artfully done. I wanted it to be real, but I also wanted it to have a slight distance and an elegance that illustrations were able to provide. So we decided on this style. It's an artist I work with, my ex-boyfriend, Landis Blair, and much better collaborator than boyfriend. And he has a really Edward Gorey pen and ink style, but he did this one a little, he sort of went out on his own, journey of discovery to do these illustrations.
Did you give him pictures?
I gave him pictures, yeah. So most of the illustrations in the book are based on real pictures, and then sometimes he would pull from other sources and... Yeah, to create them. And I'm really happy with how they turned out. I think that they really, there are a lot of things in the book that I try and describe, but having a visual makes it that much better to put you there and to give you a real sense of what it looks like. This, like I can describe the 360 degrees of Buddhas, but you're like, okay, I don't quite know what that would look like. And then you see this and you're like, oh, it's literally little pockets of 360 degrees of Buddhas.
So you're a professional mortician and you have a YouTube channel. And you also write books. Tell me a little bit about the process of sitting down and writing this book. Just read that passage about sitting cross-legged, it's very funny. And there's so many funny asides in this book, even though it's very powerful and in places scary and sad. What's it like for you sitting down and writing? Or do you just dictate to a minion?
Oh, that would be amazing. No. Can I do that? Is that what that count? I'd like to dictate to a minion. That sounds like my goal in life. That was not how I wrote this book. The first book that I wrote, starting in 2012, was more of a memoir, and at the time it seemed really difficult, but looking back on it, I hadn't opened my own funeral home yet in Los Angeles. And I got to quit my job at my corporate funeral home to write this. So I got to write my memoir with no other job, at various cabins around, I would just go from cabin to cabin to work on my writing. And it seemed hard at the time, but I look back on it and being like, what magical life was that you led? Because this book, now I have a funeral home, I have a nonprofit, I just have a whole, bunch of stuff that I do. And we have employees now, we have people who work for the nonprofit, and there's just so much stuff going on, which is exciting because it means the death revolution continues apace, but it means that...
But people are always dropping off.
People are always, yeah, exactly. People are always dropping off, metaphorically and actually. So this book was much more kind of right as I go. There was a point where the last place I went was Bolivia, and I was there... The day of this festival of the Ñatitas was the day of the U.S. presidential election. And so I was there, and it was my last trip for the book. And the next day, I was like, I'm really, you know, I'm on deadline, and I'm just like sitting there, like writing the last chapter of the book, crying, like, you know, and I'm alone in this weird little Bolivian hotel room. So it was definitely not the like magical cabin experience of the first book. It was kind of like where you can write this book, you'll do it. But I think that if you want to be a writer, you kind of have to professionalize yourself at a certain point, right? Isn't that what a lot of writers say, that you can't take yourself too seriously at a certain point? You have to be like, this is my job, and this is the work, and I have to show up, and if I'm waiting for magical inspiration to hit, it's not going to do that. You have to just sit down and do it.
Yes, there's a wonderful writer named Susan Strait who talked about how when her daughters were young, she would like be waiting to pick them up from like soccer practice and be like writing in the car behind the wheel.
I can't imagine having a child and writing a book. That seems, I'm so, I mean,
people,
it's amazing,
do it all
to
the time.
Me. I know people do it all the time. It's amazing to me. I cannot imagine it.
But you have sort of the opposite of children. You have all these dead people you're
trying
to take care of.
I have all these dead people who are, you know, they're also very needy. Also very demanding on my time.
Well, it's interesting you bring up the, is it nietas? No.
Natitas, yeah.
Natitas. Mm-hmm. They are they're almost exactly the opposite of Japan. It's mm-hmm. this sort of ancient tradition, and it's very physicalized. Mm-hmm. Could you tell us a little bit about what they are?
Sure, yeah. So it's coming up now. I think it's on November 8th. So it'll be about a week from now, while they'll have the festival of the Natitas. And the Natitas are from the indigenous Bolivian tradition, and they are skulls. And the idea is that skulls and mummified heads, some of them, but the idea
is
that they're real human heads.
Bones.
Yeah, they're not like a sugar skull. They're real, real skulls. And the idea is that ñatitas have to be skulls, but not all skulls are ñatitas. You have to be special to be a ñatita. And it's people, mostly women, who come from this indigenous culture, who will bring these skulls into their home. They're not necessarily family members or people they know. They can be places from a, you know, from a cemetery or an archaeological site, and they feel called to these particular skulls, and they'll ask them, they'll name them, bring them into their home, and make offerings to this skull. And what I found so fascinating about this is that this is also a very Catholic culture. You know, and it's the Catholic Church is not happy about the ñatitas at all. And because what it does is it bypasses the male priests of the Catholic Church. Normally, you'd have to go in to confess to the priest or talk to the priest about your problems. But with the ñatitas, people come into the home and they'll say, "Hi, Sandra, the ñatita, I have such and such a problem. I brought you this offering. I brought you this thing. Can you help me solve this problem?" And you're bypassing the church to pray directly to the beyond through a skull or mummified head. So it's like these women have this way, and it's a lot of domestic problems too. It's a lot of women with their children and people who feel like they're not getting as much attention from the Catholic Church, having this almost like hack, you know, this way to bypass the system.
Is it always women?
It's not always women. It's definitely men too, but the ones that I visited that were sort of the heavy hitters in the game, the ones who had like 40 ñatitas on the wall, they were more women, and they're dealing with things like love and with protecting your family and with finances for your children and things that I think are considered, you know, not as important to a male culture or to a priest, but of course are vitally important to the women who are dealing with them.
So just like I could make an appointment to go get my palm read, mm-hmm. I could make an appointment to go to pray to a
exactly
ñatita.
Yeah, exactly. So we went to several places, and this is also Dr. Paul Kudinaris, who I went to Indonesia with, and he's been going for 9 years. And there hasn't been, what was really important to me about this particular chapter is that there hasn't really been any scholarship done on this. So it's not like I can go to the scholarly record from the anthropologist or whoever it is who studies Bolivian ñatitas, because there isn't really one. There's one in Spain, I believe, who does it.
Do you think that's because it is this sort of female outsider?
That wouldn't surprise me. Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me. And it's this indigenous tradition, and it's not really well known outside of Bolivia. There's been a couple articles in Smithsonian, but most of them are just Dr. Paul's research. So he's really the one who knows almost more about it than anyone else. And he'll show up every year, and he took me to these women's, and it's really just, you know, you pull back the curtain in the back alley behind the cemetery, and you walk into this small little foyer in a small house with a concrete floor, and there's, you know, 50 skulls on a wall, and they're all wearing green beanies with their names on them. And it's just like, visually, you're like, this is the most, if you're interested in death, when you walk into that house, and then they also have the iconography, or like the visuals around the skulls, are so amazing. They wear beanies, they have flower crowns, they have cotton balls for eyes sometimes, and they smoke cigarettes. They like will have a cigarette, a lit cigarette, hanging out of their mouth. And God bless them, I was like, Paul, you know, do you think they like smoking? Like, what's the point of the cigarette? And he's like, yeah, of course they do. Of course they like smoking.
What's it going to do, kill them?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, you know, they enjoyed it in life, and they enjoy it now. And it's a
with
nice,
zero
if they're,
consequences.
They're helping you, you know, talk to the afterlife. You might as well hook them up with something they like. There's also, you know, people would bring them watermelons. They would bring them bottles of Coke. You know, it was just like things they thought the skulls would like.
And you said that there's a ceremony on November 8th?
Yeah, so that's the festival of the Niatita. So everybody, all the Niatita owners, it's kind of their coming out day, like they're like a quinceañera or like a debut, or, you know, it's like a time to go out and do their thing. And they all come to the big general cemetery. And this has been fraught over the years because, again, the Catholic Church doesn't love them. So about 8 years ago, they all showed up with their Niatitas, and this is hundreds of people who show up with their Niatitas, and the main chapel at the cemetery was locked. And they were like, no blessings, we do not condone this, we do not believe that Niatitas are real, you shouldn't have them, it's sacrilegious. And the people with their Niatitas marched through the streets, like pumping their skulls in the air, saying, we want blessings, we want blessings. And finally they had to open the church and let them in. And the priest this time, someone was there translating for me, said that basically it was much more conciliatory. It was like, we all here together, and don't we all deserve a blessing? And, you know, it was like much more watered down language. But it's amazing, though, because people, they're so proud of their Niatitas, and they're so proud of having them and what they do for them. It's like their special day. It's like their children. They're like, hey, showing them off. And they set up these stands all through the cemetery, and you go through and you can just see the diversity of skulls and the decorations, and it's just amazing.
So did you ask a Niatita for anything?
I asked Nacho, which was a Niatita in this woman named Doña Ana's house, and she was supposed to be incredibly powerful. She was supposed to be an incredibly powerful Itiri, or witch doctor. And I asked Nacho to influence the U.S. presidential election that was happening that day. And I think Nacho did not habla inglés. perhaps didn't quite get the message that I was sending to Nacho. So Niatitas historically have not worked well for me personally. But maybe that's because I didn't come with the right, you know, open heart and mind, or maybe I wasn't, you know, asking the right questions.
And you're often operating in this place where you are coming up against people's deeply held beliefs. I mean, it's funny to think about the guys with the cigarettes, but for you, have you found a way to navigate like beliefs from many different cultures?
Yeah, I mean, I think people have asked me, you know, you seem so open-minded about other cultures kind of doing whatever's meaningful to them. Why do you talk about the American funeral industry so negatively? And my position on that is like, because I work within the American funeral industry. I own a funeral home. I'm a funeral director. This is the community I'm a part of. So I feel like I can speak out against it from within it, and I'm well within my right to critique it in that way. Whereas if I go and I'm looking at the indigenous culture of Bolivia, I'm not going to be like, oh, these silly ladies with their skulls. I'm going to be like, I'm going to look for the angle. Like, isn't it incredible that they're bypassing the Catholic Church and doing this? Isn't the reasoning behind this moving and impressive? And I think it's a lot, one of the reasons I wanted to write the book is that with my first book and with other things I've seen, it's so easy for people in America to look at the Indonesian mummies, for instance, and go, oh my God, whatever happened to RIP? This is so disrespectful. How undignified. Rest in peace. Oh my God. You know, just this real scathing, you know, read on it that they just couldn't. It's like, well, you know, everybody really cares about their dead. Everyone around the world is trying to do right by their dead in the way that they know how. And the only culture that really kind of ignores their dead sometime is ours. Everyone else is for the most part, deeply involved in death rituals and death culture. It may just not look like what you think it should look like.
Well, it might just be that I, like, totally just drank your Kool-Aid when I read this, but Indonesia seemed very natural to me and really normal. It didn't, partly because the way you portray the community interacting with the mummies feels very sort of loving and routine and not weird.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel psycho.
No, it really was. It was, you know, kids running around and having a great time and just happened to be some mummies out. And there was, what I get all the time is I get questions from people like, my dad died 12 years ago in upstate New York and he was embalmed and he's in a wall crypt. What does his body look like now? Tell me exactly what his body looks like right now. And I get that with some frequency. And normally I have to say, you know, there's a lot of factors that go into that. There's humidity, there's soil,
He looks exactly like a young Robert Redford.
Yeah, exactly. He's a babe now. But I mean, I think that interest in the dead body shows that people are interested in checking in on their dead loved ones, even if they're have been dead for many years, and they're almost just acting on that instinct.
Right.
You know, they're like, I want to know what my dad looks like. Oh, we'll just unwrap him from his grave and check him out. Oh, here he is. Hi, Dad.
Hi,
you know,
Dad.
It's almost this like natural instinct taken to its most, you know, curiosity taken to its furthest place.
So the thing that struck me as perhaps the most radical death practice that you visited in the book is the human composting. There's probably a better way to say human composting than human composting.
Well, she's now branded it recomposition.
That's what I mean.
Is the word for it, because
Which human composting
is a little intense.
And that was right here in America.
That's right here in America. Yeah, and I wanted to put some instances of America in the book because I wanted people to know that this work is going on here, too. There's hope for us. There's really interesting things going on in America. And one of those is right now in North Carolina at a body farm or a human decomposition facility, which is connected to a university. And normally they study forensics and the decomposition of a dead body, but they wound up partnering with a friend of mine, Katrina Spade, to test.
Is her name really Spade?
Spade, that's her real, yes, that's real. That's not like a cool death name. She's not like, I'm like, hi, I'm Caitlin Coffin and this is my book. No, her name is really Spade, and it started as her master's thesis in architecture, and has just kind of become her life project. And this body farm in North Carolina volunteered to be the first place to do these experiments with putting human bodies in these piles of wood chips and alfalfa, and testing the temperatures, and testing, like, will they compost, basically.
How much moisture. If you have to flip it over, like,
yeah,
the one in your backyard.
Do a little aeration. And it was beautiful there, and I got to, and again, this is an example of, like, oh, it's a small community. So I'm like, Katrina, can I come with you to uncover some composted bodies? And she's like, yeah, sure. Excellent. And so I went with her, and it was so interesting because a lot of the things that are being said about her and her project are very similar to when cremation was new in America. Like, oh, this is disgusting. Oh, this is vile. Is this disrespectful? All the same talking points are being used on that were used on cremation, which is now incredibly accepted, and over 50% of Americans choose it. So it feels like, who knows if corpse composting is what's going to be what catches on? But if it is, it feels like I was there at the start of something, you know, using my little plastic spade to uncover composted bodies.
Yeah, that was really fascinating. Mm-hmm. Because it...
Is that it, one of the chapters you were eating breakfast during?
Yeah. I was like, oh, this turned out not so well. Oh, and that... it was like gross in lots of ways. And your book mostly avoids grossness, but... Before we get into that, I want to see if there are questions in the audience. There are people who have
microphones
who will come to you.
Yeah.
I was going to give them a heads up, but they're such professionals that I'm hoping they will forgive
me. Move. We got microphones.
And,
oh,
and they, they're
now.
Picking
Hello,
you.
Hello, everyone.
Hi, everybody.
Hi.
First question over here.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. My background's anthropology. I'm really interested in death rituals. I've been to Tanatoraja.
Oh, cool.
Up in Sagada in the Philippines, and to see Mashimon in Guatemala, and so forth. But my favorite kind my favorite type of burial, and I would love to see it here. And I've buried both my parents, the dysfunctional American way. And I do think it is really removed and, denial and the makeup on the dead and embalmment. But my favorite type I would love to see come here is the Tibetan sky burials or Zoroastrian Towers of Silence. So any, movement on that?
Those are in the book.
Yeah, it's in the book. So it's in the book because I didn't go to Tibet because they already have such a problem with Chinese tourists coming in, like with their iPhone and taking pictures of the vultures eating, and it's all, there's already such a fraught relationship there. I didn't know anyone there. I didn't have, nobody invited me, and that's another one. I didn't want to just get on the Chinese tour bus and show up and do it. I felt that was disrespectful, so I drew a line there, but it's a shame because that's actually what I would want for my body, if at all possible. Right. Yeah, there's definitely a taboo there, and it's I did a TED talk at TED Med, and my opening line was, "When I die, I would like to be eaten by animals," and that was like I thought that was kind of a cute opening line, and the guy who ran the talks was like, "I don't know that we can do this. This might be too much for TED," and I was kind of like, "Trust me, it's gonna land." People are going to, I'll have some supporting sentences for it. People are going to eat it up. And at the end, to be fair, at the end, he was like, "You were right. It really went over." And I was like, well, there is that taboo. But I think when you put it in the sense that, like, listen, I'm a vegetarian now, but I've eaten tons of animals in my life. Am I not an animal? Do they not deserve their turn with me when I die? And to be part of the the idea of a natural burial, just being in the topsoil and having the things and the little creatures in there eat you is great. But what about the bigger animals? Why hide myself beneath the ground when they can have a shot at me? I've been saying this for a little while. We're not any closer to its legalization in the U.S., unfortunately. I spoke about the body farm. There is a body farm at University of Texas San Marcos that does experiments with vultures. So they put your body out and not to be composted, but like to have actual vultures, to test what that looks like and to study it. And, so that's kind of our one shot right now. But hopefully there's more to come and we can all be eaten by vultures. Mm-hmm. Congratulations, everyone. Lucky you. Yeah.
Yes. I was interested in your talk about Indonesia because I've spent a lot of time there in the last 19 years, and I actually lived in Bali for a year, and I got talking to my guide because over the thing about cremation, because I thought it was funny that they were advertising these trips to these cremations that had never heard of such a thing, and now you talked about, the mummifying of the bodies and so on, and my experience was that they mummified the bodies because they couldn't afford the cremation, and therefore they had to wait till there was a royal cremation or someone with money, and then you just dug up your person. And I talked to people, village people and in hotels, people who owned cheap hotels and things like that, and they nearly always had a story about how they were waiting for the cremation. Yeah. Where did you actually say you were where they were keeping the mummies and digging them up again? Where was that?
What a well-traveled group we have here today. You're all like, actually. The place that I actually was in South Sulawesi, more specifically Tanatoraja, South Sulawesi, which is one of the... Yeah, exactly. It's much further down. Not a lot of people go to South Sulawesi. But you're actually absolutely right. A lot of the people, what I didn't mention is that a lot of the mummified bodies get kept in the home. So the family lives with the mummified body. And the reason they do that is because the funeral is incredibly important. And it's incredibly important for there to be enough, you know, pigs there to sacrifice and enough food and a buffalo and all of these, you know, raising enough money for a funeral can take several years. And in that time, the body will just live in the house. But there are other, they're not a cremation culture there, but in Bali, something I would love to see, which I haven't seen, is like you were mentioning, they put the rulers, when they die, they put them in this giant jeweled bowl and they roll it down the street and then they set the whole thing on fire. And it's like a Burning Man, except with a two-story jeweled bowl. And I haven't seen that, but I would love to go see that. Thank you.
Hi. Hi, yeah. So I am a part of a large group of people who is half one thing and half another. I am half Mexican and half homogenized white mixture. So my life was very, oh, don't touch the dead body. You're going to be, you know, you're going to die from it. And yeah, grandma's in the back room. Come give her a kiss before you help me dress her. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering, do you believe that the line between, at least in the United States, between the death positive culture comes from the fact that some people just don't want to accept this, you know, kind of, because we're so, you know, such a really big, like, or really a melting pot, as you would. Do you believe that the line is because we have so many cultures and there's so much going on that people are just like, whoa, you know, a backup, I don't want to do this anymore? Or do you think it lies somewhere else?
That's a really great question. What breaks my heart constantly is the fact that we have, obviously, this incredible diversity of cultures, of immigrant cultures, of religious cultures, and for the most part, they are sucked into this incredibly cookie-cutter American funeral industry. So you can go, you know, you can have your big Mexican family that's completely ready to keep mom at home and do all these things, and they go to the local funeral home, and the local funeral home says, oh, you can't do that in America. No, we don't. No, we'll take your body and we'll embalm it, and we'll bring it here, and you can go to the wake here, and this will be $12,000, thank you very much. You know, and you have that happen again and again. It happens with Muslim people, it happens with any Latin American culture, and it's really, really sad, because they come in with this already really engaged culture, and then they go to some kind of funeral home that tells them that it's not possible. And this is, again, like we talked about earlier, the American funeral industry has to step up and say, my job as a funeral director is to facilitate what you want. And in your case, if what you want is just to dress grandma on the back, that's all they should be there for, and to help you file the death certificate and help you move on. And so I think traditionally what has really made things suffer is the fact that all of these incredibly diverse traditions haven't been allowed to flourish because they get shut down by the American funeral industry and the mores that are already in place, because laws are state to state in the American funeral industry, but each state has a strong funeral lobby that's at play, and they want to keep things the way that they've had things since, you know, the hearse was a buggy whip carriage.
Isn't part of this to our own personal relationship with death? Like when my mom died, we knew it was coming. So my dad was prepared to figure out what to do. Like, if somebody just drops dead, or if you're taken aback by grief, mm-hmm. even if you were prepared for it, doesn't it help if the decedent has talked to their family about what they want and what they expect? And part of that means, like, I have to reconcile the fact that I will die someday.
You'll die. Oh, yeah, you will. Oh, yes, you will. You bet. Hopefully not soon.
Homogenous,
but you sure
American.
Will.
La, 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 la.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And obviously, we have to make it easier to talk about, too. But the sort of sweet spot combination is somebody who's already had a talk with their family, and they may want to do something a little different, and then someone dies, and they go to the funeral home, and the funeral home, without hesitation, goes, oh, yeah, what were you thinking? You know, that's the kind of comedy. You need both. It's a dance. Like, I'm not totally blaming the funeral industry. I'm not totally blaming the population. We both have, like, worked on this denial dance together, and now we need to work on this non-denial dance together. And everybody gets to be on the same page, and then we can have something closer to a good death. And by that, I mean a death that is closer to what you wanted and you've prepared for and you've given some thought to what is valuable to you. Come on down. Hi.
Hey, I was wondering what yours and, like, the, I guess, death workers' consensus generally on, like, post-humanism and, like, transhumanism and, like, the future, like, post-body.
Yeah. I don't want to speak to other, like, funeral directors because I'm not really sure. I would say for the death-positive movement, I'm a little worried about transhumanism in general because I think that it just speaks to a deeper entrenched denial. So transhumanism meaning either radical life extension or like uploading your brain to the cloud when you die. I think that it's really a problem because I think that, first of all, I think that when you're talking about the people who want to extend their lives, they tend to be people of privilege in places like Silicon Valley. And they're not into everyone getting this life extension. They're pretty open that they're interested in life extension for themselves. So it's only going to radically widen the gap of inequality when these, like, you know, Elon Musk type... Actually, Elon Musk has been pretty good about warning against AI, but when you have these Silicon Valley types who, you know, want this for themselves, for people like them, and not for anyone else... and I think also part of what, at a more sort of existential level, part of what gives our life meaning is the fact that we're going to die. It's the deadlines, the emphasis on dead, that death provides that allows us to want to create and be in this world. And extending life, when we don't really take care of most of the people on Earth as it is now, is not a fabulous idea. So I could go on and on about this, but I personally take issue with it, and I'm happy to die right on schedule, do my part, get out of the way, and I hope to encourage others to do that as well. Not early, no one, not telling you to die early, just, you know, on schedule.
We actually have a question from our Facebook viewer.
Oh, that's fun.
This question
Hi,
is
Facebook.
From...
Where's the Facebook camera, by the way? Is it, like, up it's there? Up Hi, there. Facebook. Hello. There's, like, two people there.
Yeah. We have a lot of viewers. This is from David. You've mentioned a couple times that you dislike zombies and zombie culture. Why is that?
Oh, okay. Why are you a zombie hater?
Yeah.
I'm not a zombie
hater.
What
up, zombie hater?
Yeah, come on, zombie hater. I'm not a zombie hater. I just, I believe that the fact, it's telling, I think, that zombies, which are just corpses, they don't have superpowers. They don't really do anything except walk around as a slightly decaying corpse. The fact that that can be so horrific to us, that just a simple decaying corpse doing what a corpse naturally does, the fact that that can be so terrifying to us, I think, is really telling. And, you know, at least pick something scarier that's actually scary. You know, but the fact that we
like
don't have any decomposition, like a vampire that can do something, you know, at least it can do something.
It can give you eternal life. Oh, wait, I'm sorry.
Yeah, oh, God, that's terrifying, too. Yeah, all of these things are terrifying. Well, that's cool, though. That's kind of what is cool about horror, though, right, is that it's playing on all of our fears around death and dying and the dead body. But whatever's popular at the moment, I think, especially goes to our fears. And the fact that zombies are so popular says to me that we have a weird relationship with the dead body.
Hi, thank you. I have it on good authority that the Veterans Affairs are moving very slowly, in part, to green burials. Is that the same as what you were talking about, the corpse farms, or different? Could you touch green burials?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'd love to talk about green burials. I'll talk about them all night. Green burials are one of the main things that my funeral home offers, and we actually just did our first veteran cemetery green burial about a month ago. And what green burials are is, so you might just call it burial, because all it is digging a, you know, three or four feet hole deep in the ground and putting a shrouded body or a body in a decomposable casket with no embalming, just straight into the earth to be straight in the earth.
And then
most
you, like,
people
cover it up.
Then you cover it up with some dirt, and there you go. And most people think that's what burial is at a typical cemetery. It's not. In the vast, vast, vast majority of cemeteries in the United States, when a body goes in the ground, it's chemically embalmed. That body is in a big sealed hardwood or metal casket, and then that casket goes into a big concrete vault under the ground. And so people have this idea of dust to dust, but that body isn't coming anywhere near the dirt around it. It's in a fortress underground. It's in Fort Knox under the ground. And so a lot of people are turning to this idea of actually going into the ground to decompose. It's not against the law anywhere. It's cemetery policy. So any cemetery that wants to open a green burial section is well within their rights to do so. And so more cemeteries are doing that, and the VA is hopefully moving towards that possibility as well. We had to, with our body, we had to, our person who died, we had to do a, you know, through Jewish custom, we had to argue that this person was Jewish and they should be allowed to be buried without the big vault that they usually require. But we did get it to happen. It was a bit of a fight, but our funeral director got it to happen. But yeah, I would love to see them move in that direction and to allow that for anyone who wants it.
Hi, thank you. So you talked about Americans being terrible at death. Mm-hmm. Have we always been bad at death, or was there a turning point? Why weren't we the best at it after the Civil War?
Yeah.
Like, was there a point, you know, where we had a good relationship with it and where that shifted?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Americans should be the best at everything, right? Yeah, America. Yeah, no, we used to be pretty, we used to be totally normal at death. Prior to the Civil War, we kept the bodies at home. We, you know, took care of them ourselves. People died in the home. We killed our own animals at home. It was a very, you know, there's a lot of death. And to be fair, like, there was also a very high infant mortality rate. So it wasn't this, like, death utopia 150 years ago. And the advances in medical science to prevent death are great, and I'm all for them. But what happened at the turn of the 20th century is that we lost, you know, our connection to death at home. People were dying in hospitals instead. We lost our connection to waking people at home. People went to funeral homes instead. And we lost our connection to killing animals at home. People went to slaughterhouses instead, or animals went to slaughterhouses instead. And so all of a sudden, all this death that we had around us is like, poof, gone. Where's our death? And that kind of put us in the position we are in now. And nobody is suggesting that we go back to a time where everybody dies at home, even if they have an infectious disease or even if they're an infant, or, you know, we're so happy to have hospitals. But there's no reason that people can't die peacefully at home. So many people, I think it's something like 90% of people want to die at home and only 10% get to, or some statistic that's terrible like that. There's no reason people can't die peacefully at home. There's no reason people can't be taken care of at home after they die. So we're never going to go back to a time like 150 years ago, but there's so many inspirations we can take from that and bring back into our death culture, and also just a more open, honest mourning culture as well. It's, you know, it's Dia de los Muertos, and that's, you know, yeah, hey.
couple of white girls sitting up on stage.
Yeah, a couple of white girls appropriating a sugar skull here on stage. It is beautiful, though. But to have that kind of open death culture where we say, yeah, we visit the graves years later, we welcome people back, we have this ongoing relationship with our grief and mourning. Contrast that with, you know, going into an American office and you have to come back to work 4 days after your husband died and pretend he didn't, to not bum out your coworkers. You know, that's a problem too. So I think that we can do so much to bring back a positive relationship with death that doesn't involve actually going back to the systems of 150 years ago.
Okay, so we have time for one more question, and then you'll be doing a book signing, and people can talk to you when they buy your book.
We can chat after. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Hi.
What would you say are the unique challenges of running a funeral home here in Los Angeles?
Oh, man. And now we're going to be here for another 45 minutes. Thanks for asking that question. You know what the hardest thing for me is there's always these stories about people who are trying to do the same work that I am. about, you know, and then someone died at home, and then we took a horse-drawn carriage through the village with the body, and we buried them on their property, and we just took the death certificate down to the local registrar, and the family did it by hand, and it was this completely involved, beautiful thing.
That like is, now, in the modern era?
This is in the modern era, but this is like in Pennsylvania or like these places. That is not what's going on in Los Angeles. We were actually talking at dinner before this about how I would love to say that a family should say, like, suck it, funeral homes, like, I'm doing this all by myself. But the fact is that's virtually impossible in Los Angeles because we all have, at funeral homes, have this thing called the electronic death registration system, which everybody has to use to file a death certificate, basically. A family doesn't have access to that. Only funeral homes have access to that. And it's very difficult to do if you don't have a funeral home. Transportation, obviously, is really difficult. Nobody's taking a carriage through the streets to do that. You cannot bury people on your property in California, period.
You can't even, like, bury your dead cat on your property.
You can't even bury your dead cat. I mean, wink. You can probably bury your dead cat on your property. but you're not technically supposed to. So it's harder in this big metropolis that's hugely bureaucratic to still try and create that family-driven sense. So a lot of things have to be a lot more symbolic than I would like them to be. Like, I would like people, like, digging the grave on their, you know, on their hands and knees, weeping if it was up to me. But we can't quite get away with that. So, but I think that I like working in the belly of the beast. I think it would be a lot easier to work somewhere more rural or somewhere with better laws. But I think that if you want to really change culture, you kind of have to go into the belly of the beast in the hardest place and see what you can do. And that's what we're trying to do.
Caitlin Doty, thank you
very much.
Thank
you so much for coming.
The book is...
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the Estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information.